namely Sri Rupa Goswami, Sri Sanatan Goswami, Sri Raghunath Bhatta Goswami, Sri Raghunath Das Goswami, Sri Jiva Goswami, and Sri Gopal Bhatta Goswami, who were engaged in chanting the holy names of the Lord and bowing down in a scheduled measurement. In this way they utilized their valuable lives in executing these devotional activities. They conquered over eating and sleeping and were always meek and humble, enchanted by remembering the transcendental qualities of the Lord.
Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Prajayane Shri Krishna Chaitanya Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasudevaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare
Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
So in this verse Srinivasacharya is explaining a very, very important principle of devotional life. He's explaining that the six Goswamis were engaged in chanting and sadhana in a scheduled measurement. Towards his final days, he said that Raghunath Das Goswami, his daily sadhana was this: 1,000 obeisances to Krishna, 2,000 obeisances to the Vaishnavas, 100,000 names of Krishna, 3 hours of listening Chaitanya Charitamrita, and 2 hours of sleep, and a couple of drops of buttermilk. That was Raghunath Das Goswami's sadhana. Haridas Thakur, he simplified it a bit. He just chanted 300,000 names of Krishna. Sanatan Goswami, he also chanted many names of Krishna, but he had also extra sadhana. Every single day he would do Govardhan Parikrama. And he said that along with doing Govardhan Parikrama, he would also offer 1,000 obeisances to Govardhan Hill also. So the Goswamis were engaged in doing their sadhana according to scheduled measurement. Sankhya Purvaka. Sometimes people say spiritual life is so natural, why do you have to make it so mechanical by giving numbers and by setting goals and by, you know, having such quantitative measures of spiritual practice? But the idea is that all of this spiritual practice is natural. But first we have to learn how to be natural. So it seems like a paradoxical statement. We have to learn to be natural. But that's actually what spiritual life is. We're learning to be natural. And therefore, in the beginning stage, we have to go through what seems like a mechanical and sometimes monotonous process. But then that mechanical and so-called monotonous process will unlock the spontaneity. Say for example, if one wants to learn the piano, then for many months and sometimes even many years, you have to just learn the notes. Dun, 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 dun. It's like very boring, you know? It seems like you do this every day, or like now in the ashram, it's like everyone seems to be learning the mridanga. It's like whenever you come up to the ashram, it's just, you know, these beats, you know. They're not even like kirtan beats, they're just sadhana beats. And sometimes, you know, it's very, can get on your nerves a little bit. But that sadhana is needed. Dere kirta, dere kirta, dere kirta. And then you're trying to go faster. Because when you learn the basic, and the basic sometimes often seems very monotonous, but when you go through a sadhana of doing that, then what happens? Eventually you can sit in front of a piano and not even think about it, and then just play And then when you play the piano and you've learned the basics, then you can just pour out all your emotion and all your heart and all your creativity in creating music. Or when you play mridanga, once you know the basic beats, then you can go in a kirtan and then it's almost as though your emotion just takes over because you've learned the basic. So by learning the basic, what it helps one to do is unlock the spontaneous. But that basic sadhana must be there. Say for example, if one wants to express their deepest feelings in writing, but they never took the time to learn vocabulary or learn grammar or learn sentence formation, which is all very mechanical stuff. If you never took the time to learn all of that, you may sit down and say, now I'm going to write and describe my deepest feelings, but you won't be able to express anything. So therefore we have to learn to be natural. And therefore it's here it's said that the Goswamis were teaching this, that one must engage in sadhana in a scheduled measurement, with determination, with diligence. Spiritual life basically goes through an archetype progression. If you think about churning butter, then how does it start? Someone begins churning the butter with a lot of enthusiasm, stage number one. Stage number two, after doing it with enthusiasm for some time, there's basically not much results. So then that brings doubt. So stage number one is enthusiasm. Stage number two is very little result, which brings doubt. Stage number three, hopefully, is that one still carries on with determination, even though they're seeing very little result. And then stage number four is finally the butter comes. It's an amazing result. So basically, that's the archetype progression that everyone is going through. Initial enthusiasm, very little result, which leads to decreased enthusiasm and increased doubt. Third stage is basically continuing on despite the difficulty. And the fourth stage is that one that eventually sees an amazing result. So, patience is so much required in spiritual life. He said that patience is bitter, but its fruit is sweet. So patience is very much required, because only one can only really perceive a change in their spiritual life over a period of sustained practice. Sometimes day to day we look at our spiritual lives and we think, oh, I'm doing really well, or no, I'm really out of it. But actually we're just looking day to day, and day to day there'll always be ups and downs. If you really want to know whether you're doing well, or if you really want to know whether you're out of it, then you have to see over a period of time. Because day to day the fluctuations will always be there. So patience is required, patient practice, that's very, very necessary. And it said that patience and enthusiasm, both together. If one is patient but one is not enthusiastic, that's the mode of ignorance. If one is enthusiastic but they're not patient, then that's the mode of passion. But when one is patient and enthusiastic, then that's said to be the mode of goodness. So patience is needed. And even sometimes when we don't think we're making advancement, advancement is often imperceptible. There's so many analogies you can use for that. Imagine you're in a plane and you're flying above the clouds, then it doesn't seem as though you're going very fast. But 8 hours later, when you arrive on the other side of the world, you go down the clouds and you arrive on the other side of the world and you realize, well, I came a long way. Difficult to perceive the speed at which you're traveling. The hair, you shave your head, you know, and then day to day you can't see the hair growing, but over 1 or 2 weeks, then yeah, you see, the hair's been growing. Water dripping on a stone, moment to moment, you can't see that much is happening. But if you return 10 years later, then it's created a big dent in the stone. So like this, through patience, one is actually, everything is coming. So It just requires one to be a little patient and continue on, as the Srinivas is saying, with their sadhana in a scheduled measurement. But sometimes people say, what's more important, quantity or quality? Should I chant 4 rounds really well, or should I chant 8 rounds not as well? So like, what do you do? So actually Prabhupada said both are important, quantity and quality, and you cannot separate the two. Because where there is quality, there will naturally be more quantity, and where there is more quantity, then naturally more quality will come, because one is applying themselves in a greater way. So quality and quantity are more important, are both important, and therefore here it says Sankhya Purvaka, one must measure. One must measure what they're doing. In Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj's time, he said that if one doesn't chant 64 rounds, then they're falling. That was his measure. Where did he get that measure from? He said that when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was travelling village to village, then many people would invite him for prasada. But he said that, I will only take prasada at the house of one who is a lakhpati. So generally lakhpati means one who has 100,000 gold coins or rupees or whatever. So his servant said, there's not many like that here. He says, no, I don't mean one who has 100,000 gold coins, I mean one who is chanting 100,000 names. I will take prasad at the house of such a lakhpati. 100,000 names is 64 rounds. And so that's where Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj got the measure from. That if one does not chant 64 rounds, one is considered fallen, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu will not come to their home. Prabhupada obviously reduced this to 16 rounds, seeing the capability of the people of this age. So he said 16 rounds and no less. So that scheduled measurement, that benchmark must be there. So the Goswamis had their measurement of a certain number of obeisances and rounds, so we should have our measurement. And we should follow that diligently, patiently. And then just as the Goswamis are showing us that sadhana leads to bhava, which leads to prema, then similarly our sadhana will lead to bhava and then eventually prema, hopefully. So the Goswamis were engaged in chanting the holy names of the Lord and bowing down in a scheduled measurement. In this way, they utilize their valuable lives, and in executing devotional activities, they conquer over eating and sleeping. So this is another very interesting point, that by devotional practice, one actually conquers even the basic activities of the body. Oftentimes, the bodily necessities, they're not necessities. Actually, we're just doing these things more because of the mind. Oftentimes we eat, not because we need to eat for the body, but just because it's good for the mind. Oftentimes we sleep, not necessarily because we need rest, but it just helps to pacify the mind. So, actually when the mind is conquered through devotional practice, then one actually does not need to engage in these activities in the same way. One actually becomes transcendental to these activities. Once Tribhuvanath Prabhu, he said this in a class, that he was falling asleep in Japa time. He was at Soho Street. Don't try this at home. So the way he did is he went to the top, I don't know if any of you have been to the top of Soho building with Tulsi. Now they have barriers there, but previously actually they had no barriers on the roof. So then he was falling asleep, so then what he did is he went onto the top of the Soho roof, and then he stood on the edge of the building, and then he began chanting his rounds there. And he said, I didn't fall asleep there. Mm-hmm. He said, because sleep actually, most of the time it's just in the mind, it's due to a lack of attraction. And therefore oftentimes when, you know, Prabhupada would say that to devotees, right? You're not sleeping because you're tired, you're sleeping because you have no taste. Of course, we do have a bodily necessity that we have to meet, but most of the time we're engaging in these activities because of a lack of absorption, enthusiasm and inspiration in spiritual life. When one is absorbed, then these things become inconsequential. You don't see a need for any of these things. So absorption in something is very, very powerful. That's why they say in lifts, in elevators, they have mirrors for two reasons. One is to make the lift look bigger than it is. But the other reason is that because it's often an uncomfortable situation being in a lift, because you're like very close quarters with all these people that you don't know. So the reason they put a mirror in there is that because everyone starts looking at themselves in the mirror. And then when you get absorbed in your own bodily image, then you forget about everything around you. So it makes it easier for people to deal with being, and you don't realize the time it's taking because you're just absorbed in your own body. So that's actually one of the psychologies behind having mirrors. So through absorption, one can actually conquer even the bodily necessities of eating and sleeping. And therefore, because the Goswamis were so absorbed, these things were not important. And we sometimes have that experience that we're so engaged in service, we're so engaged in spiritual life that we may forget to eat. He was telling me yesterday, Radhe Shyam Prabhu, when they were opening the Pune temple, for 3 days he didn't sleep or something. So that's possible. One can become so transcendentally absorbed that they don't require these things. So it said that the Goswamis were like this. They utilized their valuable lives in executing devotional activities and conquered over eating and sleeping. And then in the final part of the verse, Srinivasacharya says, they were always meek and humble, enchanted by remembering the transcendental qualities of the Lord. So this character of the Goswamis, of being meek and humble and exemplary Vaishnavas, this in one sense was one of their most powerful types of preaching. Being a good example and having good character is actually the most powerful service you can perform. It's the most powerful service because, number one, anyone can do it. You don't have to have a special ability, you don't have to have a special talent. Everyone can be a great example. It just means you have to conduct yourself with the right qualities. So being exemplary is the most powerful service because, number one, it's the most universal service. Everyone can do it. Number two, being exemplary is the most powerful service because you can do it at any time. We chant maybe in the morning. We give a talk maybe at a certain time in the day. We honor prasadam at three times in the day, whatever it is. But being exemplary, it's not time bound. You can do it at any time in the day. So that's why it's also considered very powerful service. Being exemplary is one service that no one can ever take away from you. Every other service, you may get a chance to do it, or you may not get a chance to do it. But being exemplary, you always have an opportunity to do it in any given situation. One has an opportunity to be exemplary. And the final thing is why being exemplary is the most important service, or the most powerful service, is because it's something that everyone will be able to connect to. You may give a class and some people will like it, some people won't. You may lead a kirtan, some people will like it, some people won't. You may write a book, some people will like it, some people will not. But the one service that everyone will be able to connect with, that everyone will be able to appreciate, and that will inspire everyone, is one if one actually becomes a person of spotless character. That is the most powerful service we can do. So here the Goswamis were always meek and humble. And this is actually the measure of advancement. Srila Prabhupada once said that advancement is not based upon position within an institution. Advancement is based upon how humble one has become. And therefore, this is one who is proper character, they actually become the most influential people. I think this is the real measure of advancement. John, social scientist Max Weber, he says there's two types of people who gain authority in a spiritual institution. He said one is the priest and the other one is the prophet. A priest, he attains his influence in a spiritual institution by his position, by the position given to him by the institution, by the title that he has. But he said a prophet, he attains his influence in a spiritual institution through his character, through his qualities, through his purity. And he said of the two, the prophet is more powerful than the priest. And therefore, Goswamis, they were definitely prophets because they had amazing character. It's interesting, he said they were meek and humble, enchanted by remembering the transcendental qualities of the Lord. So being humble, our humility is in relation to Krishna's greatness. We become humble not by meditating on ourselves and meditating on how insignificant we are, but we meditate on the greatness of Krishna, on the greatness of Vaishnavas. And when we meditate on the greatness of Krishna and the Vaishnavas, then in comparison to them, we feel automatically very humble. So humility is not a meditation which requires one to negatively meditate on themselves, but real humility is coming from positive meditation on Krishna and the Vaishnavas. And then one naturally feels humble, and at the same time they don't feel depressed. If we just meditate on how fallen we are, then we may feel humble, but we may feel depressed at the same time. Therefore, natural humility is coming from an appreciation of Krishna's qualities. And therefore, Vaishnava Maharaj says nicely that humility doesn't mean to think less of yourself. It means to think of yourself less. It doesn't mean, humility doesn't mean we just look at ourselves and just see all the faults, but it just means we just stop thinking about ourselves as much. We focus on Krishna, we focus on the Vaishnavas, and in the light of their greatness, we realize our insignificance. So that's real humility. So ultimate humility means seeing the world from Krishna's point of view. Right now we're seeing the world from our point of view. But when we naturally become humble, we see everything from Krishna's point of view. That's basically the position of the Goswamis. So here in this verse, three main things we talked about. First, the importance of practicing devotional life in scheduled measurement with patience, having a fixed sadhana. Number two, we talked about how through such sadhana and devotional absorption one can actually conquer over bodily necessities. Number three, by doing this one actually develops proper character, they become meek and humble, and this humility is ultimately coming from an appreciation of Krishna's transcendental qualities and position and how insignificant. Our humility is coming from an appreciation of Krishna's greatness and our insignificance in relation to Krishna's greatness. Questions?
Just to come back on, you said that our humility is in relation to the greatness of Krishna and Vaishnavas. So when you're thinking about the greatness of Vaishnavas, how can you make sure that that doesn't become envious? Or how can you make sure it's appreciation, not envy, especially if you're thinking about your peers or the people around you?
Basically, if you see everything in relation to Krishna, see Krishna is the supreme source of all qualities and ability. So if we develop an appreciation and consciousness that Krishna is the source of everything, then even when we see the quality and characteristics and abilities of other Vaishnavas, then when we see that, we see that what they have is ultimately also coming from Krishna. So when we see that everything is coming from Krishna, then we don't become threatened, or we don't become depressed, we don't become demoralized by someone else's success. Because we know that they've been favored by Krishna. And that's amazing. So the amazing thing in devotion, in material life, we're thinking that it's limited. If someone gets something, then I don't get it. But in spiritual life, we realize that it's unlimited. So if someone gets mercy from Krishna, then that doesn't limit my ability to also get the mercy from Krishna, and therefore we don't feel threatened by someone else's success. Often we take it in a material way, and therefore we think, oh, if that person gets glorified, that's less glorification for me, so then it becomes a disturbance to us. But obviously we're looking for glorification, but the point is that Krishna's mercy is unlimited. So I think there's two important things. The first thing is to see the character and qualities and abilities of Vaishnavas as having its source in Krishna, and therefore again when you see it, it increases your appreciation of Krishna. And I think the other thing is to realize that Krishna's mercy is unlimited. So then to be happy that someone else is getting the mercy of Krishna, knowing that that doesn't reduce my chances. But it takes time. He was quoting someone and he said, more difficult than feeling pain in someone else's difficulty is to feel genuine happiness in someone else's success. When someone's going through a bad time, it's easy to some extent to feel sorry for them, because inside of us there's a subtle kind of happiness that this person, you know, is kind of comforting to see someone else's distress in some sense. Especially to kind of recognize and see their distress is easier. But then when someone is successful, it's much more harder to appreciate it. And to be genuinely happy on seeing someone else's success. So that's something which definitely takes time. But see it, everything as having its source in Krishna, and see that, you know, mercy is unlimited.